From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
On today's show, we're talking identity, national and personal. First, we stop by the Republican National Convention.
It really is just the economy is bad and it's Obama's fault. We really haven't seen very much in the way specifically why it's Obama's fault.
Then we hear the story of the man who wrote America's first slave narrative.
This narrative is the first time white people saw Southern slavery through the eyes of a slave.
And we'll take on the American ideal of success and the reality of failure.
So you can't be afraid of failing. You just have to be able to learn from it.
We know you'll learn something today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Earlier this afternoon, Governor Jerry Brown announced that he's reached a deal with state lawmakers that would mean sweeping changes for California's public pension system and affect hundreds of thousands of state workers. The new rules would cap pensions while increasing the amount employees pay in, and they'd increase the retirement age by up to 7 years. At a press conference, Governor Brown said the move would save the state tens of billions of dollars, though the state's pension office has not yet run the numbers. The governor said, quote, if the legislature approves these reforms, public retirement benefits will be lower than when I took office in 1975. Public employee unions decried the proposed changes, saying they'd make it harder for the state to recruit and keep crucial employees like police officers, firefighters, and teachers. Senate Republicans, on the other hand, argued that the governor's proposal doesn't go far enough and that they'd prefer to see even more drastic cuts. State legislators will vote on the pension package later this week. The Republican National Convention is underway in Tampa, Florida, after being postponed because of Hurricane Isaac. Although it's been on the quiet side overall today, we were curious as to what the mood is like, what delegates are talking about, and what to expect over the next few days. So we caught up with San Francisco Examiner contributor Melissa Griffin for her impressions on how the event is shaping up so far.
It really has not been a huge and exciting morning. I mean, Ryan Priebus, not the most charismatic speaker, got up, gave the opening thank you and welcome, and it was really kind of a tepid response. And the most recent speaker just got on the stage, and it was very interesting what he said. He said, "You know, welcome to the convention. I want to thank you for coming out. We're going to make sure this year that Obama's a one-term president." And what I thought was interesting about that is he didn't say, we're going to elect Mitt Romney. He said, we're going to make sure Obama's a one-term president. And that's kind of my overall sense of things here. It's a lot less yay Mitt and a lot more no Obama.
And anti-Obama, what issues are they focusing on to get their people riled up?
It really is just the economy is bad and it's Obama's fault. We really haven't seen very much in the way specifically why it's Obama's fault. But I assure you, anything that's wrong in the world today is Obama's fault.
And as you look around the room, what's the diversity like?
There isn't any. I've seen almost, I think, fewer than five African-Americans.
You could, like, count them.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Five among how many, about how many people?
I think, what, 20,000?
20,000. Interesting. What about women? Recently, a number of Republican figures have been in hot water because of Todd Akin and his little quip on women. So what is the women's presence like?
The women that are here wear very high heels and have blonde hair. And I say that as someone who is wearing high heels with blonde hair. So there's a bit of a type. They're the people who you might imagine would be here. And I'll just give you an example. I was at an event the other day about social media and politics, and the room was pretty diverse in terms of male to female. And they opened it up for questions, and not a single female asked any questions. And so they're here, and there's been an effort made to integrate them into the proceedings, but they're definitely not speaking up very much. They don't appear to be really taking over any part of the platform so far.
Who are you looking forward to hearing from?
Chris Christie.
Why?
Well, because he's hilarious. Because he says what he thinks, And even though I disagree with him, and I think what he said about California is kind of rude, but at least he's honest and he's entertaining. I mean, the truth is, this is a pretty boring set of proceedings, and if you have somebody who will tell a good dirty joke every once in a while, it certainly breaks up the monotony.
You've been to Republican conventions and Democratic conventions. What's the biggest difference between the two?
I think the most obvious thing is the diversity. I think you just, any alien who landed and went to one, and the next day went to the other, would go, well, that's obviously, this is where the brown people are. You know, I think that's just what you see very, very quickly from the outset, from just eyeballing it. You could show me a deck of cards, and I'll go, that one's for the Republican convention. That's pretty clear. And this year, however, I don't know that the Democratic convention is going to be much more excited than this one is. I mean, both sides seem to be a little somber at their prospects. I think people like Obama, they don't want Mitt Romney to be president, but it's a little less, I mean, 2008 is just impossible to compete with. You're a Democrat. I mean, that was just a really amazing, life-changing millennial event for a lot of people. And I don't think either party is going to capture that this year.
And what's going on with Ron Paul and his delegation and the people with him?
Oh, it's just fascinating. I'm talking to these guys. They're really interesting. The Republican National Committee has worked pretty hard to make sure that Ron Paul delegates aren't getting sat. And this is all a bunch of machination that's happened prior to getting here today. But one of the things that's going to happen is these delegates who were bumped for various reasons are going to try to pass a motion to allow themselves to be reinstated, basically, as delegates. And that's going to be a bit of a fight. Mind you, they're going to lose all of this. But it is going to be a show. And what the reason it's important is because, A, it's going to be interesting in a sea of uninteresting things, and, B, it really does show that the Republican Party is deeply fractured. There's a reason why the committee works so hard to keep these people out and keep them quiet. They don't want the world to see that there's a large percentage of people in the Republican Party, even here, who are not on board with Mitt Romney. And keeping that part quiet is going to be very important. And watching that dynamic is going to be, again, one of the most interesting things that happens here.
That's San Francisco Examiner contributor Melissa Griffin. We spoke with her at the Republican National Convention, and we'll check in with her next week at the Democratic Convention. In the meantime, you can find links to all our election coverage on our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A big presence at the RNC, literally and figuratively, is the Republican Party's internal opposition, the Tea Party. Though the Bay Area leans fairly liberal, you don't have to look under barrels of tea to find local Tea Party supporters. KALW's RTM's Konohovs met a few in San Francisco's Justin Herman Plaza.
You know, there's no equality here. It's obvious. You know, it's all one side, lopsided. Like the whole state is, it's just worse here in San Francisco. I live in Hayward, and at least there's a little more tolerance for both sides.
And it is hard living in a state that just always votes in one direction because it isn't doing us any good. We just get more and more in debt and don't change our ways, and the legislature is being run by the unions, and hardworking people like me just get the shaft and get handed the bill.
We're supposed to be, the Bay Area especially, is supposed to be a place of tolerance and, you know, acceptance for everybody. And I've got gay friends and lesbian friends and transgender friends and Muslim friends and Hindu friends, but I get discriminated against because I'm a conservative.
Well, I went through the UC system and I feel like I was really indoctrinated to kind of be the liberal and do the liberal thing. And then probably at some point in my 30s, I started to question a bit, but it was really well into my 40s that I did my own work and did a lot of homework, and I decided that's not for me. So,
like, you can't put a bumper sticker on your car because it gets keyed, you know, or torn off. Or just in casual talk at the dog park, somebody will say, you know, well, thank God there are no Republicans here, you know, and you just keep your mouth shut.
That was Pete Tall of Hayward, Lori Sweet from Napa, and Caroline Vaughn and Lisa Murphy from Marin County. So do you support the Tea Party? Join the discussion on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. And for a bigger picture look at Republican prospects this fall, here's local comedian Will Durst.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few words on Mitt Romney's vice presidential pick, Paul Ryan, the big-time budget guru of the GOP. Everybody keeps calling it a bold choice. Yeah, well, maybe, but you know, bold is not always synonymous with good. Whiskey for breakfast is a bold choice. Spunglass underwear is bold. Forehead dragon tattoos. Passing an 18-wheeler on a blind curve doing 80 in the rain. Incredibly bold, just not that necessarily smart. It's generally assumed a major reason for choosing the Wisconsin congressman was to energize the base, and that's a slam dunk. But which base? Republicans? Yeah, definitely. Haven't seen them this excited since John McCain hooked up with the governor of Alaska 4 years ago. On the other side, Democrats are salivating so hard they should be wearing bibs to protect their $5,000 suits. Took less than an hour before attacking Ryan's budget bill, which replaces Medicare with vouchers. But then the Romney campaign counter-accused Obama of taking $700 billion from Medicare. So brace yourself for an echoing refrain of, "You're killing Medicare. No, you're killing Medicare." Rinse and repeat. Allegations have arisen that while Ryan maintained a steadfast opposition to the stimulus bill, he wrote 4 letters to the Secretary of Energy praising stimulus programs and requesting funds for his district. A little bit of flip for Mitt the Flop? Ryan doesn't do much to help the Richie Rich thing either. In March, he amended his financial disclosure statement because he forgot to include a $5 million trust account. And who among us hasn't done that? This campaign arc better start rising soon, or Romney might be forced to actually release his tax returns just to change the conversation.
Will Durst is a local political comedian. His show, Elect to Laugh, plays tonight and every Tuesday night until Election Day at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Will Durst joins a long line of comedians who've based themselves in the Bay Area.
The earliest job I ever wanted was like a stand-up comedian or something. I did like stand-up when I was in like elementary school, junior high or something. And I was always kind of like building stuff in the background. Like I'd build model rockets and RC cars and stuff like that.
That's San Francisco resident Thomas Reeve. He's long since abandoned his stand-up comedy dreams, but all that building he was doing in the background as a kid, well, it's paid off. Reeve is now a mechanical engineer, and he's also the subject of our next Hear Here story.
Here?
Here?
Here.
Okay, together. Okay.
Hear Here,
a pop-up radio project.
Our Hear Here community storytelling team met Reeve in the city's Potrero district, where he shared some of the life lessons he's learned through engineering. But first, he started off by describing his job.
Playing with clay or Play-Doh or something. That's basically what I do, except my Play-Doh costs more and it stays in one piece when you're done. My name's Thomas Reeve. I live in San Francisco, California, in Potrero Hill. Right now, I'm a senior mechanical engineer. If you can hold it in your hands, it's something we made. So like cell phones, tools, cars, planes, boats, plastic housings, thermoform things. I built my first computer in junior high, and I was able to fix other people's pretty much since like 6th, 7th grade. Then I got into computers with a bunch of friends, and they all became electrical engineers, and I realized it was not for me. My brain didn't click that way, and it's too perfectionist for me. Like, you have a comma in the wrong place, nothing works. What I do a lot is I'll draw something on like a napkin or a sheet of paper, and then we go figure out how to make it real. And you have to build it a lot of times to see. You can only run the numbers so much before you get to the point. Like, the math assumes everything's perfect and real world isn't. You'll never have everything working the first time. And so they have things called revisions where, like, you'll see it in the back of you. Look at like a remote control or a barcode on a TV. You'll see like rev A, rev B, rev 6 or something. And that's basically the count of how many tries it took them to get to that point. So you can't be afraid of failing. You just have to be able to learn from it, because you'll fail a lot, but you have to be able to sort of learn from that quickly and then iterate to get something that doesn't fail.
That was San Francisco resident Thomas Reeve. This story was produced by KALW's Erica Moo for our new community storytelling initiative, Hear Here, a pop-up radio project. To find out how you can meet the Hear Here producers and share your story, just go to KALW.org and click on What Else? Hear Here. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Our storytelling project brings you stories from people in the here, here, and now, but many stories are compelling because they reach back into the past.
My name is Regina Mason, and my great-great-great-grandfather was an interesting man. He was a property owner, a barber at Yale, a shrewd businessman, an intense author, and a runaway slave.
That's part of a trailer for the upcoming film Gina's Journey, about Oakland resident Regina Mason's search for her family history. Being an African American, that meant slavery. Her 15 years of research took her through libraries, documents, city and county registries. She made visits to relatives and consulted a family Bible. And eventually, Mason discovered that her great-great-great-grandfather, William Grimes, was not only a slave, but the probable author of the first unedited autobiographical slave narrative in American history. The unedited is important. Most slave narratives at the time were put out by publishing houses, mostly owned by whites. In his book, Grimes details life as a slave in great detail, as well as his escape and life after slavery. And 230 years later, Regina Mason joined me in studio to share his story.
I was born in the year 1784 in the county of King George, Virginia, in a land boasting its freedom and under a government whose motto was liberty and equality. I was yet born a slave.
Powerful beginning.
Very powerful. He makes it clear the contradiction of American liberty.
He seemed empowered. As I was reading the book, it's a long list of grievances against the country at the time, but at the same time, he sounds empowered somehow, that I can do something about this. I'm going to write it all down, and someone someday is going to read it.
Right, right.
Like, there's empowerment. There's a sense of despite everything he's been through, there's
empowerment. That is absolutely right. His book is like what my co-editor Bill Andrew says is a list of grievances against the United States. He is outraged. He's undone. He's angry. He's bitter. And it turns out, after I really got into this book and I started putting it on a timeline and finding other documents to corroborate his story, I found out that he wrote his story so soon after being found by his master. His teen years he spent on the Thornton Plantation. That was his second owner. And by the way, he had about 10 different owners. He makes his escape in the year, I believe it's 1815, if I'm not mistaken. Okay? And that's from Savannah, Georgia, and that's with his last master.
There's a part in his story where he gets a horrible toothache.
Oh, God.
And his master then, this was when he was still a slave, and then his master pulls his tooth out, fracturing his jaw and basically making his pain even worse. And then he goes and drinks to relieve the pain and ends up in jail. His description of awaiting his fate in that jail cell and the people who came through it, including women being disrobed and beaten, and a man whose back was so whipped, he said it was like a field lately plowed. His expressions reflect an education.
Right.
The way he writes.
One man who was confined in the same room with me by the name of Reuben, belonged to John Bolton, one of the richest men in Savannah. This poor man's back was cut up with the lash until I could compare it to nothing but a field lately plowed. He was whipped 3 times in 1 week, 40 stripes, save one, and well put on by this athletic fella. You may well think this poor Negro's back was not only well lacerated, but brutally and inhumanely bruised.
And he closes it with an even more powerful message to America. He says, I hope some will buy my books from charity, but I am no beggar. I am now entirely destitute of property. Where and how I shall live, I don't know. Where and how I shall die, I don't know. But I hope I may be prepared. If it were not for the stripes on my back, which were made while I was a slave, I would, in my will, leave my skin as a legacy to the government, desiring that it might be taken off and made into parchment, and then bind the Constitution of glorious, happy, and free America. Let the skin of an American slave bind the charter of American liberty. William Grimes.
It just seems to know that your great-great-grandfather went through so much would not be something easy to go through.
It was very painful, and I even get emotional about it now, because his life, when we think about lives, they matter, they're important. And he tried at every turn to live a life that he felt good about, or to live a life where he could exist somewhere and be someone. But he wouldn't find that in the South, and he certainly didn't find it in the North either. So to, yes, read about his sorrows, his tragedy, it was very, very painful. And I remember the minute I was able to come to realize that he was, in fact, my great-great-great-grandfather. When that moment of truth came, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I could do nothing but weep. It was just that powerful. But yet it was triumphant at the same time, because the audacity of this man to write his story and to fiercely get it published at a time when reading and writing was a rare and sacred privilege for white people. And then for his book to say, written by himself, it was just a bold and revolutionary statement to make, which is probably why this book has laid dormant for so long, for almost 200 years, because scholars didn't know quite what to do with this narrative because it reads so bitterly. You have to understand, this book is before any nationally known anti-slavery movement. It is before William Lloyd Garrison, the famous abolitionist, declared himself an abolitionist. It's before Freedom's Journal, the first African-American newspaper. It's before Nat Turner's Great Rebellion. Okay? So once we realize this, we see where this narrative stood alone. And it must have been such a awful sight for white people to read it, because, and this is powerful, this narrative is the first time white people saw Southern slavery through the eyes of a slave, okay? Nothing else had been written that spoke to Southern slavery. And then for it to come out of the mouth of a slave, that was quite powerful.
Regina Mason is editor of The Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave. And if you'd like to contribute to the launching of the film version, go to KALW.org and we'll show you how. And many thanks to KALW's David LaTulipe for his reading of passages from the book. listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, RTM's Connor Hovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Anna Sterling. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear what it's like to be chronically homeless in San Francisco.
You know, a lot has happened to me in this alleyway right here.
Living without a home in the city. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
Oh, the sun, where you've been.
You're listening to San Francisco resident Paula Fraser. She opens for Will Sprott and the Mumblers this Thursday. It's the last of this year's summer concerts in the Redwood Grove at the UC Berkeley Botanical Gardens. Music starts at 5:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Here